Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strands here live from the Kintec Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And the Dunbar Lumber inbox is fantastic today. It's always great, but lots of people telling us what they're having for lunch and how they're being antisocial and isolated from their coworkers and listening to us instead of talking to them, which, again, I fully approve of. Also, somebody sent in a picture of the steaks they're picking up at Costco, which look delicious. So shout out to that guy. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Now joining us to talk about the Canucks game last night and the schedule going forward as well. As I mentioned, first time on the show in a while. Happy to have him back. He is from The Athletic, Harmon Dial. Harm, how's it going, man?
Doing amazing. Super excited to be back with you guys.
Yeah, we're really excited as well. So that result last night, I mean, obviously just a huge comeback for the Canucks to get the 2 points eventually. Yes, it's an overtime, but a regulation loss there would have been just devastating for them. What was your number one takeaway from that game last night for the Canucks?
Yeah, to me, a comeback like that could be a turning point for the Canucks this season, because headed into the second intermission, there was every reason to think that they wouldn't come through, right? They had the tired legs from the second leg of a back-to-back against a rested Calgary side. You got a banged-up D-core, just 12 shots in the first two periods. Dustin Wolf's been phenomenal in net. And most importantly, the Canucks didn't have a single victory this season when trailing after two periods. So especially with the context of how disappointingly they blew the 2-1 lead in the second period, it was all adding up to a pretty grim picture heading into the third period. So for them in a situation like that, with their backs against the wall, to dig deep and not just score and tie the game, but to thoroughly pump the flames on the shot clock as well, 17-4, play with a level of desperation and urgency that we haven't seen from this group very often. And most importantly, for the hero to be Elias Pettersson, that's massive, because imagine being, let's say, a middle lineup or a depth player in that Canucks locker room. How much of a lift is it not only to get the 2 points, but the way it happened, where it's your best forward finally coming alive? He's got three goals in his last four games now, plus Quinn Hughes in his return logs nearly 30 minutes and is doing Quinn Hughes type things. That's got to inspire a lot of confidence in this group.
Harmon, what do you think the Canucks did well in that third period to allow them to generate shots unlike they've done at any point really all season?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think to a certain extent, a lot of it was Pettersson. Like, he just kind of took over to a certain extent. It was interesting where through the first half of the game, I actually thought it was a pretty quiet night for him. I remember at one point in the first period looking at the underlying numbers when he was on the ice, and I think shots were like 4-1, 5-1 in Calgary's favor. And then as the game went on, though, you could see the signs of, okay, he's starting to pick up a little bit of confidence. Course, got the secondary system power play. When he operates and finds that top level gear, when he's playing with a level of confidence and swagger that we haven't seen very often from him this season, plus Quinn Hughes is controlling things from the back end the way he was, like, that's just a level of, I think, performance at the top of the lineup that the Canucks haven't gotten lately, because Quinn's been out and because Pettersson's been largely dormant outside of these last few games. So I think a lot of it starts with your best players really being your best players.
On Elias Pettersson, I think there's been more excitement and positivity around his performance last night than in any individual game this season. Now, I was pumping the brakes just a little bit earlier in the show, saying, like, look, that was a good game, no doubt about it, but it still wasn't a vintage peak Elias Pettersson performance. Are you looking at it as more as, hey, Pettersson is back now, they should expect high-end performances from him going forward? Are you looking at it as just another step in the right direction? How do you view that Pettersson performance in context this season?
I don't think it's his peak, but the way I view it is he's starting from such a low point that it's rare you're going to see a player go from scuffling and looking completely ineffective to all of a sudden he's dominating games. It's usually a gradual progression for players to sort of come out of a slump, especially one this long as it sort of has been for Pettersson. So for him to string over the last five games, I think four of the last five, I've been impressed by his all around play. So it wasn't his peak performance. Again, I thought through the first half of the game, he was pretty quiet, and there was one point even where I was looking at the ice times, and Noah Zaman had played slightly more 5-on-5 minutes than Pettersson, and that's a huge part of it too. Is Rick Tocchet gave him full freedom, just said run, go. Which in at times lately we've seen Pettersson's ice time cut. That's, I think, an important thing too for a player like Pettersson that feeds off confidence, is just giving him that ice time and the confidence that an elite player should be getting. So I think there's an element from the coaching staff as well, where now that you see that his game is starting to build, I'd like to see him consistently hitting 19, 20 minutes a night, as opposed to sort of being in the mid to high teens.
What did you think of Nils Höglander's game and both the good and the bad?
Yeah, Höglander's really interesting because with his energy, he's been so noticeable on the forecheck, winning pucks back, just being a pain in the neck to play against. I'm still waiting for a couple of things. First, the finishing. It feels like there's at least one grade A chance a game that he gets that he's not bearing. And if he wants to be consistent, you know, playing up the lineup in the top six with Elias Pettersson, he's going to need to hunker down on some of his chances. And that's where, yeah, for the last couple of months, I've been a big proponent that, hey, he's driving play. His underlying numbers look fantastic. The Canucks are creating a lot, but there's got to be an element of finish there as well. And then secondly, as well, there are still moments where, you know, game management or certain spots where he's turning pucks over, or it's just plays that you kind of scratch your head at. And I still think the good largely outweighs the bad, but there's still, I think, some room for him to take the next step, because yeah, you can see with his speed, with his motor, his effectiveness on the forecheck, that he's bringing something to every line that he's on. But there's still another, I think, gear for him to reach once he's able to, in my mind, hunker down on his finishing and really hone in on and refine some of his decision-making with the puck.
Yeah, and that pairing specifically of Höglander and Pettersson, I mean, we've seen the lines juggled so much over the last couple of weeks here, understandably, because nothing has really worked. Nothing has really clicked. You know, those two, we know there's a relationship off the ice. They've had success in the past together. I don't want to say they should be, you know, stapled to each other and given top line minutes, because as you said, look, there's still times where Nils Höglander has to make better decisions out there, but it does look like down the final 17 games here, that duo could be a big part of the solution at the top of the lineup for the Canucks.
Yeah, especially because you just don't have many other great alternative options. When I look at the challenge for Rick Tocchet lately in trying to configure his lines, the big question has been, who has chemistry with each other? That's why he's constantly had to turn to the line juggler and line blender. And even when you look at this crop of wingers that they have, right? Brock Besser has had a really tough time producing and looking effective since JT Miller left. Connor Garland sort of doing his thing, although not driving play and being as impactful as he was to the first 30 games of the season. They're just lacking difference makers. I mean, wing and at center. At the top of the lineup, I think Drew O'Connor's sort of gone a little bit quiet, which, I mean, to be fair to him, it's not his fault that he can't produce in the top six role. He's really a third liner in an ideal situation. So the opportunity is there, and I think given the flashes that Hoglander has shown, he deserves to get a bit of an extended look there.
Yeah, and I think also even just beyond this season with Nils Höglander, you look into next year, and we're already talking about the team needing to add multiple guys in the top six. Who knows what's going to happen with Brock Besser beyond this year? And, you know, Nils Höglander, that $3 million extension kicks in next year. I think he's been kind of off the map for much of this year as a potential top six solution. But if he can do enough in these final 17 games to change that conversation a little bit and, you know, not be written in ink or anything for a top six spot, but at least be a viable option, that could be a big deal given the rest of the work and the amount of the rest of the work the Canucks already have to do to their forward group.
It'd be massive, especially because coming off the year that he had last year, look, we understand to a certain extent the 24 goals. He was riding a bit of a shooting percentage bender, but even baking that regression in, looking at how effective he was at 5-on-5 as a play driver, in my mind, I was sort of thinking, especially after you signed that extension, there were sort of a lot of positive vibes. I was thinking to myself, could he be sort of like a poor man's Connor Garland, right, for you, where he's just that spark plug, a player with his combination of the work rate, the speed, and having good enough hands and enough skill to complement other high-end line mates. I figured he could be a difference maker, especially on a team that likes to forecheck and play this north-south style. Unfortunately, it's gone sideways for him this season, but I think the tools are still there. I've largely, even when he's been at his lowest point this year, I know he's got his flaws in terms of the IQ and the defensive side of the game, but I've still largely been a believer in his tools, especially for a team that just up front doesn't have much juice offensively. So absolutely, if he can find some traction down the stretch, build some confidence back up in his game and continue some of the good work he's done over the last couple of months, all of a sudden, now you're not looking at that $3 million investment for next season as inefficient.
What were your thoughts on Victor Mancini?
Really impressed. It's interesting too, because the first two or three times we saw him in the lineup, I thought to myself, okay, this is a big body who moves really well and is actually pretty poised against heavy forecheck pressure. That was the first thing that stood out. Was,
but, right? There's a but coming here.
I mean, I actually, like, the but in the first two, three games was he's doing it in limited minutes in a really sheltered role.
And they were getting outshot, like, by a lot.
Yeah. Although the chance metrics weren't bad at all.
Yeah, okay.
Like, I think the chance metrics have been, like, they've controlled two-thirds or something like that. I know the shot metrics haven't been as favorable, but small sample, and maybe the shot metrics are a little bit more favorable there, but we'll see, right? Anyway, like, my first thought there was, okay, this guy looks like he could play in a sheltered sort of role and give you competent minutes, especially because the bar is low, right? We saw Juulsen and Desharnais logging minutes, and I wasn't a particular fan of either guy. And then the key last night was with Tyler Myers out, he's now forced to play nearly 18 and a half minutes at 5-on-5, and his minutes weren't sheltered. Kadri and Huberto were among some of the forwards that Mancini spent the most head-to-head 5-on-5 minutes against. And in that capacity, I mean, the Canucks crushed the Flames, 13-7 shots, controlled 81% of expected goals. And you saw the confidence sort of building for him with the puck in the offensive end. He's taking care of business defensively. I don't think the ceiling is very high for him necessarily, but he looked competent logging those minutes, and that's just another sort of quality piece to sort of have on the back end at a time when your blue line's starting to get a little bit banged up.
Looked like a young Will Borgen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm serious, though.
I like it.
I know. Will Borgen's obviously the spirit animal of Canucks talk, but looked like a young Will Borgen. It's like, yeah, it maybe caps out as a four, but nice to have big-bodied right-handed shooters that can move well and actually do a little bit offensively. Like, the thing I really liked was once his ice time spiked, like in the third period, multiple instances, including on the game winner, where he was getting pucks through to the net, and he was like the one-point shooter who Dustin Wolf seemed to be unable to control their rebounds.
Yeah, and I didn't really know that he had that type of secondary sort of offensive pop. And that's the thing, right, is in today's NHL, even if you're going to be a defense-first guy, and I think this is part of the mistake that this manager group fell into last summer when they were constructing this blue line, even if you're going to target big bodies who, in your mind, are defense-first guys, they need to have a baseline level of competence in terms of their mobility, in terms of how they move the puck on breakouts, and not taking too much off the table offensively. Like, the game's evolved. You can't be a pure one-dimensional defenseman unless you're elite in one specific capacity. Like, Derek Forsberg can get away with some limitations because he is an elite penalty killer and he's always going to have sort of value in that sort of specialist role. But for Mancini, this is kind of the archetype you want in, let's say, a third pair RD moving forward is a big body who can skate, who has enough puck skills that he's not taking anything off the table for you on the breakout and at the offensive end. So small sample for him, of course, only five games, but I was impressed by his performance last night.
How do you, now that we're here, right? So Canucks favored to make the playoffs in the West, but Dom's model has them sub 50%. And if you want to bet them to make the playoffs, you get plus money, right? So they're not favored to make the playoffs. They just have the shortest to make the playoff odds among the Stryver class teams. You've got the Canucks plus 110. You've got the Calgary Flames plus 230. You've got the Utah Hockey Club now in third plus 375 and the St. Louis Blues plus 425. How would you handicap those odds and sort of the Stryver class race for the second wild card spot in the West?
Well, it's interesting because, excuse me, when it comes to Utah, it's so funny. I was watching them play the Leafs the other night, and that team just, and I know Trance, you're high on them too, that team just looks like they should be better than the record actually is. With the speed that they have up front, the way that they control play, in that Leafs game, it was hilarious that they didn't find a way to win it. They were really unlucky. So for them to be only 2 points back of the Canucks, I'm still a little bit worried about them potentially catching a bit of fire down the stretch. I'd say from the Canucks standpoint, the biggest edge based off last night to me is having Quinn Hughes back and looking not 100%, but close to where he's been at this season, because the three games that Quinn played after the Four Nations break, before his most recent lineup absence, he looked like he was maybe operating at 50 to 60%. He looked like a shadow of his typical Norris Trophy level, where he was deferring. It was almost as if he was so restricted as far as having to avoid physical contact that he would see a forechecker coming at him and he'd immediately get rid of the puck, mm-hmm. Which we never see from him. He didn't seem comfortable just hanging onto the puck and ragdolling it the entire shift and having the game sort of follow him. We didn't see that gravitational effect. There were a couple of games as well where him and Hronek sort of got lit up defensively. They were on the ice for quite a few goals against. I didn't know what to expect from Quinn last night, right? Because he was in a non-contact jersey on Tuesday. You airdrop him into the lineup last night. I was thinking to myself, are you going to get something close to resembling a game breaker, or are you going to get this heavily restricted version of Quinn Hughes? And to me, it was so encouraging to see that he had the explosive burst back in his skating, how decisively he was attacking and driving the slot, and not just on the DeBrusk tip power play goal, but multiple occasions throughout the night, setting up scoring chances nearly at will. I still think you can tell he's not at 100%, but man, he looked a lot more like a game changer than he was the last time we saw him in the lineup, and that's huge for this team down the stretch. I think that gives them a leg up to the point where I still view them as slight favorites to make the playoffs, not just because of the 2 points they got last night, but more importantly, Quinn looking more like Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson perhaps finally rounding into form.
Yeah, no doubt about it. That was the biggest takeaway from last night. Harm, great to have you back on the show. Thank you for doing this. Always a pleasure. We'll chat again soon.
Thanks, guys.
That is Harmon Dial from The Athletic weighing in on last night's Canucks game and the path forward for the team here in the end of the regular season as well. We'll take a quick break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. You can send your thoughts in. Lots of good ones coming in, and we can dive into the inbox on the other side. Again, it's a day off for the Canucks. No practice today, of course, coming out of the back-to-back. You would expect them to practice tomorrow going into the back-to-back set on the weekend. And some people texting in about the games coming up on the weekend, but also about the team toughness issue. That if the Canucks hadn't won last night, I think
yeah,
that would have ended up being a big,
yep,
big talking point. So we can get into that. Send your other texts in, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line, and we'll be back in a moment here with more Canucks talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. CIBC Smart Everyday Banking helps you easily track your spending with confidence. Get $450 when you make the switch. Visit CIBC.com/smart. So as I mentioned, very lively in the inbox today. And this text came in earlier from Tim from South Surrey, who says, guys, how do you think this team needs to address the toughness or the lack of toughness that we have going into next year? This team is not team tough. This team does not have a tough guy on the team, and I really doubt that Quinn Hughes wants to get punched around, especially when the games get tough. That's from Tim from South Surrey. And of course, Calgary was paying a lot of attention to Quinn Hughes last night. And as I said just before the break, there seemed like moments where that rose to the level where somebody should do something on the Canucks, right? Hey, that's your captain. He's playing hurt. He's pushing to come back. You have to have an ultra high level of vigilance and protectiveness around that player. That it didn't seem like that threshold was getting met. If the Canucks lose that game, if they don't come back in the third, that's a big talking point today. Obviously, Elias Pettersson scores and naturally it's pushed down the list of priorities a little bit. But I do think it's a fair question to bring up and a fair concern to have about this team. Now, the question Tim poses, and specifically saying, you know, they don't have a tough guy on the team. And this one, Gary Maple Ridge says, why didn't management trade for some size and toughness? What happens if Hughes gets hurt? There goes the playoffs. Fundamentally, I think this issue is not one that can be addressed by a deadline ad bringing in a third line player who's really tough. Like, to be the type of team that has that toughness that really stands out it has to be a full team mentality, that it's part of your identity.
Exactly right.
Where it doesn't matter if we have a 6'5" guy who happens to be on the ice at the same time, who also happens to, you know, have a reputation for physicality and bite. You can have Connor Garland and Nils Höglander and Pugh Suter on the ice, but if they have the mentality to get in the guy's face as soon as it happens, that's good. That's what you need. That's what you want. Now, you want to supplement it with some guys who can take care of their business as well, of course. But more than anything, it just needs to be a part of the team identity that it's not some tough guy's role at the end of the bench to do it. It's everyone's role to stick up for everyone else, especially to stick up for your captain in those moments. Now, that's not to say that you can't maybe try to build that culture with a couple of key additions, right? Bring in players who know how to establish that identity. But it has to start with the players who are here. It has to start with your best players. It has to start with the guys who are playing a ton of minutes because they're the ones likely to be on the ice. You can, again, you can kind of marginally improve it with additions, but it's a mentality thing first and foremost, and it has to be a whole team mentality.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons that I was making the case for Braden Schenn. Right? Because Braden Schenn brings you that identity the moment he wears your jersey, right? And so I do think getting, but there's also guys like Yan Gord has that identity, and he is what, 5'8"?
Yeah.
5'9"? Buck 80?
I think Tampa's a great example. Tampa has that team mentality.
Heck yeah.
And it's not like they have a tough guy.
No.
They've got some big players, obviously, but they've also just got a lot of dogs. They've got a lot of guys who, that's how they play hockey.
Well, look, you know, it's important too in having team toughness and how you respond that you do it the right way. You don't want to do it like Connor Zeri did.
Yep.
But Zeri's also an example of what you're talking about. Guys, you know, one of those like generously listed 6 feet tall guys, 175 pounds, right? Like Zeri's a skill guy.
Yeah. First round pick.
Yeah. Might be why he didn't know exactly how to calibrate his reaction, but he knew that he wanted to. He knew that that was what the moment required. And I'm not by any means defending him for a bad hit, but the instinct is the right one. The way he delivered it is the wrong one. Like, you have to be able to do it without injuring an opponent, throwing a dirty hit, risking suspension when you're one of your team's only reliable sources of offense, and putting your team shorthanded. But that instinct is the one you're talking about. Like, that instinct is the right stuff. The execution was way off.
Yes.
And the execution led to Canucks fans being in favor of it for Connor Zeri.
look, I will say, part of having that team mentality is you're going to come up to that line sometimes and you're going to risk going over that line. That's inherent to it. Not quite like Connor Zeri did. Like, that was way over the line, obviously. But that's a bargain that teams make that, yeah, maybe we'll get burned by this occasionally. We'll get the penalty for stirring things up after the whistle. But that's a bargain we're willing to take because what it says about our team. And again, I, as you said, Connor Zeri is not a tough guy. That's not what he was drafted to do. But you can play with toughness. You can play with that fire, even if that's not your primary role, even if that's not why you were drafted, even if you do a lot of other things well. That's what the Canucks need to work to build. I don't know how you go about building that if you don't already have it. I think that's a very difficult thing to do. Like, Sam Bennett's going to be a UFA. Obviously, Sam Bennett has that in him. But if let's say the Canucks went and signed Sam Bennett, and leave aside all the thought about the contract and the other needs, I don't know if just bringing in Sam Bennett transforms the Canucks to that team, or should they just go and now they have one guy who's like that. You know what I mean? Like, it might help, but I don't know if even a player like that is transforming your team into one that has that mentality to stick up for each other.
Oh, it'd help a lot. You know, you need, I think that's where losing, you know, we talked about it with Bukla yesterday too, right? Like, the Miller practice habits thing, the Miller mentality thing, that's the real stuff that you do lose in subtracting Miller from your team. You know, I do believe that. I do believe you lose that when you subtract Zadorov from your team too.
Mm-hmm.
I think Zadorov has the ability to be one of the carriers of that sort of mentality. And look, I think in a lot of ways, this team's mentality has, I think it even applies to like maintaining a work rate, right? Like, for example, I want to bring this back to Canucks fans have had the Charlie Brown trying to kick the football experience so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it was truly what you were watching was not real. Like, you know, they took the Vegas Golden Knights. Like before we had they almost beat the Edmonton Oilers. Mm-hmm. We had they almost beat the Golden Knights in the bubble, right? But the truth is they were outshot by 100 across the 7-game series. I mean, they were, credit to them, they found a way to battle, but that was a wildly unsustainable method of winning. And the next year they lost a ton of good players and weren't as good, right? The Bruce, there it is, bump. The Canucks, first of all, got just about every penalty call. They led the league in penalty differential by a mile during the Bruce, there it is thing. And then they had unsustainably hot goaltending, unsustainably hot finishing at the same time. So similar to what we saw last year to some extent, except in that case, their underlying numbers were also in the tank. And their penalty kill remained pretty bad. In fact, do you remember they went on this huge scoring run shorthanded? They did it both times, first when they first hired Rick Tocchet and then also during the bump. Bruce, there it is. They were just a little bit lucky in every possible facet of the game.
Uh-huh.
And that made that something of a mirage. Now people are saying, well, last year this team wasn't even that well constructed. They were just fortunate. And that's not right, in my opinion. Like what we saw last year was real. That was really impressive. That was good hockey being played. I do think that the team's run of shooting form, which persisted for 5 months, right? And at one point had them producing goal differential numbers that rivaled the 80s Edmonton Oilers, right? Video game stuff. Like the three leading scorers in the NHL are the Canucks. The top defenseman scorer is Quinn Hughes, and the second is Filip Hronek. Like,
yeah.
True be a GM mode. You know what I mean? When you actually have the discipline to not sim 30 games and you're like, I'm on pace for 280 points with my top line center. Like, that's what the Canucks were doing for. Now, that was overheated. And we kept talking about the offense as being overheated.
Mm-hmm.
But the team, especially as the year went on, first of all, meaningfully improved. They became an imposing 5-on-5 group. There was some unsustainable stuff here and there. The health. Right? I mean, all of their guys except Demko basically were available all season. Garland, Besser, Miller, Pettersson, Hughes, Hronek. That's been a big difference between this year and last year. That was a little bit unsustainable. That was a little bit fortunate. Certainly the shooting fortune in the first half of the year, both on the power play and 5-on-5. I was a little overheated, maybe a lot overheated. You know, their profile was one of a sub-average NHL offensive team, to be totally honest with you. But they created that environment where they were more likely to score the next goal reliably. And here they did it in a really thoughtful way. Like one of the reasons I'm still holding so much Tocchet stock and still holding Alvin and Rutherford stock was like, okay, we have this big defense. We don't want them to get exposed off the rush. How are we going to make that work? We're going to play an extremely conservative style that's like high tempo, but where we don't aim for home run passes to set up scoring chances, and we rely on shots from the point, in part because if those fail, we're still back.
Yeah.
We're not going to get attacked off the rush. And that requires just like a wild level of effort, of buy-in, right? And then the way that the club married like speed on the wings with size on the back end and tactically with that wedge used it to make it hard to enter the zone and on and on. I mean, it was all really thoughtful, but it was the player's mentality. It was the willingness to grind out these games where like, hey, you know, 2-on-2, dump it in, right? Hey, we've got possession in the offensive zone and maybe I've got a shot to set up this guy in the slot, but I for sure have the point shot and the guy in the slot's also a pretty good screener at this point, so we'll go low to high, right? It's like a million microscopic decisions made every game by every Canucks skater to back check at full intensity, to play with the physical mentality and stand up for your teammates that this team had, the guts that this team had last year, to play defense the way Tocchet wanted to play it,
mm-hmm.
which required skating your absolute bag off. And then also to do all of that while never seeking glory offensively, right? To like really grind away and trust that you'll find deflections and rebound goals. And, you know, if we play this way, we'll win. And That was real. Like, that was a real mentality that we saw carry this team. And by the way, they found ways to win games even when the luck wore off from their shooting percentage down the stretch into the playoffs. Now, they needed more offensive juice. Don't get me wrong. Like, that, this wasn't a completed project. They tried. It didn't. It hasn't worked out this season for a variety of reasons, which we can get into later. I want to talk about what I really want to talk about is we're talking about finding that mentality as a team, and they don't have that mentality as a team this year. One of the reasons why we're talking about this group taking such a significant step back, that's locked in already, but I mean, to maybe not even making the playoffs. Certainly that was at risk late in the third period last night before Pettersson pulled it out of the fire. It's hard. Like, it's hard to play that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to sustain the work rate required, but also the buy-in required, the discipline required to be on the same page and play that way. And it's doubly hard to do when you don't have the constant positive reinforcement of wins.
Of scoring goals, too.
Yeah.
Because I do think that was a big part. Like,
they had so much success that it made it easier to buy in.
It was luck, but it also made it easier to be like, holy cow, we're winning. Let's keep doing this. 100%. Let's keep going forward.
Absolutely. And I think that's where, you know, until the third period last night, I would have said Calgary's had that mentality all year. Right? That Calgary has outworked the Canucks. We don't know what we're getting night to night from this Canucks team. They haven't had that mentality. And I think it's all the same picture. It's like the way you compete, the way you manage the puck, the way you stand up for teammates, that those have been the areas that this Canucks team is lacking in. And as much as we're impressed by the grit and resilience shown in the third period last night, I don't know that we come out of it, especially given like no response for Uyghur leveling Hughes, right? No response for,
Lomberg,
exactly. Yeah. I do think it's fair to say that there's a contrast, right? In still a contrast between Calgary, which we know has a mentality, but also limitations, and this Canucks team that is more skilled and has better players. But I still don't know that we'd say this team's found that mentality this year. They've got to. They've got time. They've got 17 games left.
And that's got to be the hope that the third period can be a turning point.
Sure.
Specifically, I'm not even talking about anything else other than just that mentality, other than the idea of the consistent buy-in, of the whole team attitude, work ethic, all of that. And Ryan in the Ridge texts in a little earlier before we started this conversation. Hey, guys, the thing that struck me was the level of emotion in the game last night from the Canucks. The three instances that stood out for me were 1, Suter after his goal, 2, Petey after his goal, 3, Mancini on the bench after Garland's winner. In all three instances, they just looked different. There was fire there that hasn't been present for a while. Here's hoping that they can keep fueling that fire towards the playoffs. And that, I think that's a good way of putting it. Just an element of fire, emotion, whatever you want to call it, that has been absent way too often this season. And with so many things, you know, we all know Quinn Hughes is bringing that every time he's in the lineup. We saw another great example of it again last night with whatever percent he's at, how many injuries he's dealing with, still managing to bring that. You know, guys like Connor Garland brings it pretty much almost every night. I've been really impressed with Philip Hronek in that regard, especially recently, bringing that consistent effort and that consistent, you know, give a bleep element. But like so much with the Canucks, if you're looking not just for the final 17 games, but into next season as well, Elias Pettersson is locked in now, if they keep him, if he's here next year, as one of the two best players on this team. And you need your best players to be a big part of that mentality. That's not to say Pettersson's ever going to be the type of guy who's, you know, first into a scrum or anything like that. But if Pettersson can set the example in practice, right, is one of the guys who's most buying in to what the coach is saying, most making all of those micro decisions that you're talking about, working the hardest, all of those things. Like, they've already got it from Quinn Hughes, but I think one of the lessons from this year is that the captain is not enough. I'm not saying just Quinn Hughes. Like, on any team, you can't just have one guy who's a really good leader, who's setting a great example, who's trying to drag the rest of the team in it. You need other guys. You need your whole leadership group, and that's got to start with Pettersson. And I think when you think about it in those terms, like, how many times has Rick Tocchet spoken about what Elias Pettersson needs to do differently in practice, how much he needs to work in practice, putting the work in, all of those things? And it was just recently where we heard him say, hey, all of a sudden, the last 72 hours, last 48 hours, I'm seeing that. I'm seeing exactly what we need to see from Pettersson. And I don't think it's just about getting Pettersson's game back on track. That's a huge part of it. But it's also about what you're talking about. It's about replacing that element that JT Miller brought. It's about being a leader, not just a great player for this team, not just a guy who can score goals, but being a leader on and off the ice. And maybe the third period, you hope the third period was a turning point, because they need that. They need that to end the season. They need that going into next year. They have it from Quinn Hughes, and they need it from Elias Pettersson now as well.
Yeah, and look, Pettersson's never going to be a rah-rah guy, but there was, I mean.
But there's other ways to do it.
Totally. Well,
if he's the hardest worker every day, he doesn't need to be rah-rah. He doesn't need to say much if he's the hardest worker every day.
No, but also, there's like a, I always come back with Pettersson to the training camp I saw him have in Victoria, which was my first experience covering him, where, you know, they come in for the 40 skate and he laps the field, right? Usually in that environment, you like skate with the vets. You know, he's in a group with guys like Myers, who was first training camp as a Canuck. He was a UFA then. You know, like established NHL players. And he's just like, nope, this is my team. Landon, who was an invite, talks about Pettersson was like dunking on guys and he had this big smile on his face. laughing as he pulls off these dekes. He scored a Forsberg goal in a scrimmage just for funsies. There was a core of competitive steel there. Now, Hughes referenced it last night. You don't get to where Pettersson is if you don't have that. But there's a core of competitive steel, a desire. Like, that was, he came and announced, like, this is my team. That's what he was saying in that moment. Now, there's been a lot of water under the bridge there. I don't know that he's always maintained that level. I think there's been multiple Canucks management teams that have had concerns about his preparation.
Wanted to get that level back.
Get that level back, been concerned that he doesn't have it, right? So, you know, there a lot has happened since then. That was two coaches ago, a lot of disappointment ago.
Yeah, that was
six years.
I was going to say almost 6 years ago.
Like, it was a long time ago. But that's there. He had it at 20. I remember being there. And I was, you know, fresh off my assignment with the Panthers. And I was watching this guy at scrimmage. And I was thinking to myself, this guy might have what Barkov didn't. Can you imagine 6 years ago? Like, I was like, Barkov, man, I don't know that he had this. I'm in. Like, I wanted to buy on that.
Conversation has changed a little bit. Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. Now, my point, though, isn't too much has happened for him to refine that. Like, you know that old, there's this, like, old quote that's like, show me the person as a child and I'll show you them as a man. Like, this idea that we...
Whatever you say.
Do you not know this one?
I mean, it vaguely sounds familiar. I don't know.
It's an old, you know, sort of saying, which is that, like, the fundamental things about your nature, you might abandon them in youth as you go through, but once you find maturity, you come back to who you are. That's the idea. So, like, that is in there if they can regularly tap into it. It's never going to be the same as the way Miller does it. The rah-rah, it's never going to be, he's probably never going to be, like, the central engine at practice. But there's still something positive he can contribute to the mentality, right?
It can be, again, it's the same, to tie it back to the original question about team toughness, I think so often fans and people in media make the mistake that you have to be, you know, Ryan Reeves to contribute to team toughness, right? But there are so many different ways to do it. And I like Connor Garland. Connor Garland's dropped the gloves for this team on multiple occasions, right? Connor Garland gets in guys' faces. He's the shortest player on the team, but he has the mentality to do it. And I think similarly, we so often think of what a leader is in hockey, is the guy who gets up and gives the rah-rah speech in intermission, the guy who's super vocal on the bench, right? Who's really leading with his emotion, wearing his heart on his sleeve. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That can work. That can be part of being an effective leader, but it's not the only way to be an effective leader. There's other ways to do it. And certainly, I mean, he's not the captain of the team. So he has to contribute to being part of the leadership group more so than being the main guy. And one way you can do that is just by working your butt off. That is a huge deal to have your best forward, your highest paid player, consistently working his tail off. That goes a long, long way. There's other things you can do as well. You talk about that, just kind of that alpha mentality where he wants to show that it's his team, that he is the best player. That's a big deal too. But there's a lot. There's absolutely a ton that Elias Pettersson can do without really having to change his personality, without trying to be something he's not. In fact, it's going to work a lot better if he's not trying to be something he's not.
Yeah. The key is, right, too, is like the next mentality's kind of where you start, right? But when you can graft onto it things like, we want to do this with our defense, so we need defenders that look like this and play like this and have these traits, and forwards who complement them by back checking like this, or then you can filter that into like buying low on players who are struggling, who you draft, pro scouting, amateur scouting, college scouting, right? Like there's this different level. And then if you have a thoughtful game plan that people maintain, that players maintain and uphold, like that's when you start cooking. Like that's when you turn things around. And, you know, I think about it as like, that's what the Detroit Lions, for example, had, right? Like you ever see that HBO clip from like the NFC North thing where the Lions got absolutely torched by the Baltimore Ravens, and the next day in the video session, Dan Campbell's showing all these clips of Amon-Ra St. Brown just like murdering guys on absolutely meaningless run plays. Uh-huh. And he's just like, F you, like just like he's bouldering these guys, like hits him twice. You know what I mean? And the line is, that's effing hope right there from Dan Campbell.
There you go.
Right. And it's like, you know, coming off the worst loss of their season, I look at that and I see hope. It's like, I'm not saying that third period can be it, because the point is to do it when it's hard, not to win a game. It's not that we look for it in triumph. It's how do you do it when it sucks? You know what I'm saying? But look, this season's a pretty big example. And if the Canucks can at least show us something, some grain of understanding, kernel of it, in terms of bringing that mentality over the balance of the season, hey, is it enough to give us a sense that this team's like on the right track? Probably not, but it's something. Certainly not nothing.
Breaking news here just before we go to break. Connor Zary suspended 2 games for elbowing DPD in the back of the head last night. So gets the hearing and then a swift decision from the Department of Player Safety. I think a lot of people were expecting 1 game. You mentioned 2 earlier in the show. I have no problem whatsoever with this one. Completely appropriate. He'll be sitting for 2 games. That's a big deal for Calgary in the thick of the playoff race.
Here. Yeah, no, he's a big loss for them. He's one of, you know, they don't have enough creativity to not have Connor Zary in the lineup. And 2 games, first offense. It's obviously a bad hit. He should have just been ejected. Mm-hmm. Maybe if he's ejected, it's a 1 game, right? But I think 2 games is about right for a player who doesn't have a history of it. But yeah, I mean, premeditated.
Yeah, there's
meant to do exactly what he did, delivered it poorly, didn't tuck the elbow. There's nothing to like about that hit, and 2 games is like the absolute minimum, but very much in line with the OPS standards.
So Connor Zary suspended for 2 games. We will take a break. Final segment of Canucks Talk is next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz, final segment of the show. We're live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their 3 locations to serve you, or online at dunbarlumber.com. Canucks.com. One thing I just wanted to mention to highlight for fans before we get into looking ahead to the weekend a little bit and just breaking down the Canucks performance from last night as well. Tom Bolander watch could start sooner than later here. His Boston U hockey team playing in the Hockey East quarterfinals on Saturday against UMass. And it's a single elimination game. Now, I believe Boston University is better than UMass, so they'll be favored in that game. But still, you never know. It's a one-game thing. And I'm not sitting here rooting for Valander's college season to end or anything like that. I don't think Canucks fans are either. But we're into that part of the calendar now where there's no guarantee, but you never know. I mean, we could be coming in here on Monday talking about, when are the Canucks going to sign Valander? Have they already signed Tom Valander? If they have, when could he get into the lineup? We'll see how it plays out, how the rest of the Hockey East tournament plays out, if they're able to make the national tournament as well. But I just wanted to put that out there on people's radar that, yeah, they've got a single elimination game. His season could potentially be over.
Yeah, and so will be interesting to see. You know, Canucks will presumably, in fact, almost certainly, put on a full court press to sign him. Those deals can be a little bit complicated to get done just because here's the truth.
Now, I guess, and somebody texts us then, I guess if they lose in the quarterfinal, they could still be like an invite to the national tourney.
Okay.
So,
but if their season ends Saturday.
Yeah.
Which we'll see. One thing that's going to be interesting to watch here is, we see regularly that players playing college hockey out east, you know, in Boston, nice place to live, pretty vibrant social life out there, world-class facilities, you know, Jay Pandolfo is the coach, like world-class coaching. It's good. Life is good. Play on weekends, work out all week, do some easy classes, hang out, enjoy life in Boston. I mean, it's fun. Like, it's great. And players are often pretty reluctant to leave. I know, like, in the past, I talked to Thatcher Demko about it. You know, he had that team with, like, Mike Matheson and Santini and, like, a bunch of other NHL-bound guys. And, you know, they lost in the Frozen Four, and it was brutal. And they sort of sat around, and it was, like, a collective decision to start their NHL careers. And if you go look at Thatcher Demko, who was a second-round pick, remember, if you go look at his entry-level contract, like, it's wild to look at in retrospect. He signed a entry-level deal, 1.35, 1.85, and 2.85 million in potential bonuses on his contract. Like, that's like first overall level schedule A's, right? Reflective of a unique level of leverage. Now, the Canucks have managed this pretty conservatively. Like, for example, the year after Jonathan LeCair, or the year before Jonathan LeCair-Mackey was drafted 15th overall, the Detroit Red Wings drafted Sebastian Cosa, the goaltender, 15th overall. He got 850K in potential bonuses. That's full schedule Bs. Jonathan LeCair-Mackey's entry-level deal only includes 475K in potential bonuses all 3 years. No graduated, like, not even full schedule Bs for Mr. LeCair-Mackey. Now, forwards, scoring forwards play earlier, so you want to manage the risk a little bit differently. I mean, that's fine. This isn't criticism of how the Canucks do it, just that the Canucks have driven a pretty hard line. Maybe that changes now that they're out of LTI, because the thing with LTI, right, is that those bonuses become carryover, a penalty basically on the next year, overages, which is something we saw happen to the Canucks cap with Quinn Hughes and with Elias Pettersson in the past. So there could be an element to which, you know, the club's priority or the club's the level of care that they take in sort of grinding those down is reduced. But certainly with the leverage that any university-aged player has, you'd expect them to have a tough time. I know this is really inside baseball, but you'd expect them to have a tough time sticking to the sort of internal cap they set with LeCair-Mackey. And granted, Valander was picked, what, 4 picks earlier? So you'd expect more, but like some Schedule Bs and some Schedule As even is like pretty standard for a guy drafted 11th overall who went the college route, given their sort of unique leverage in these talks. Does that prove to be a sticking point in talks with Valander and his you know, for now college advisor, but soon to be outright agent, Todd Diamond and company, in getting him inked to an ELC. I could see there being like at least a little bit of back and forth, a little bit of a delay,
a little bit of negotiation
relative to what you know, would think from like a guy whose CHL season ended or a guy who didn't have this sort of unique leverage. And part of that too will be got to be on the NHL roster, right? There's no roster limit. You can go well above 23, provided you have the cap space. And we know that the Canucks have the cap space. And how many games do I get into? Like all of this is part of the negotiation because really you have to choose. Do you go to the NHL this season, which burns a year immediately off the ELC, would become a 2-year ELC. Basically after the season, obviously, or do you go to the American League on an ATO, which might be better. You'd play 25 minutes a night. You'd play every night, but then you can't come up and you're a year away from a year more away from your third contract, right? So, or your second contract. So that'll be an interesting negotiation. Honestly, I'll be pretty fascinated to see how it plays out. My guess would be it does get done. Volander does get at least his full schedule B's, maybe no schedule A's. And that he starts in the show. That would be my expectation based on the history of this. I'm not trying to like do the old like will they or won't they, because I think they will, and I think that's pretty close to how it will turn out. But it might take a day or two of conversations to get there.
Yeah, and I should note again that doing a little bit more research than I had done previously, it does seem like they're pretty likely to be an at-large team to the national tournament as well. Now, you never know. Like, would an upset in the first round of their conference tournament change that? Who knows? But we're probably a little premature here on Volander watch because the national tournament doesn't get going for another couple of weeks after this one. But anyways, good to put it out there about what the shape of this could look like. And you know, one way or another, it is starting to get to that point of the calendar where all of a sudden he could be an option to finish out the season for the Canucks on the blue line in the lineup in just a matter of weeks here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now, one thing I wanted to get into that we haven't yet, of course, a lot of discussion coming into this most recent set of back-to-back games against Montreal and Calgary about how the Canucks and how Rick Tocchet and his staff would handle the goaltending situation. Kevin Lankinen gets both games, doesn't come out of the Montreal game when they're down 3-0, and plays really well last night in Calgary, helps them get a victory, especially stopping a bunch of shots in the shootout. Now they've got another set of back-to-back games. Chicago on Saturday, Utah on Sunday. Seems very unlikely, given what Tocchet said earlier this week, that Thatcher Demko will be an option for those games, considering he said he wanted to see him get 2, 3, 4 practices, right? Give him a chance to take shots with traffic, do all of those different things. How do you expect the Canucks to navigate the goaltending decisions here in this set of back-to-backs after they just played Kevin Lankinen and successfully, at least in the second one, in a pair of back-to-backs?
I mean, so Lankinen started Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I think 5 in a week is too much, right? I mean, I guess it's 8 days, but Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday, that's too much.
It's also, there's no break on the other side.
No.
It's day off, then Winnipeg. Day off, travel to St. Louis. Day off, early game in New York.
Like, and Winnipeg, St. Louis, like, those are tough games, man. And then Devils, Islanders, Rangers, I mean, those are
key games.
Those are key games, and they're not gimmies by any means. There's no, you know.
No, those are the games when you're doing the NFL schedule thing and going through and picking wins and losses that it's like they're not obvious wins or losses, but in the Canucks position or an NFL team's position, those are the games you have to win. What I mean? It's like some of them where it's not gimmies, but they're winnable. It's not Winnipeg, but it's not Chicago. They're the teams in the middle. The Canucks have to convert those to 2 points at a fairly significant clip for the remainder of the season.
I mean, so I think my view is he beat Chicago earlier this year. In fact, his one win, regulation win this season, is against the Chicago Blackhawks, which not exactly a ringing endorsement.
Nope.
I think you have to be very limited with how much he plays. Obviously, you want to buy time for Demko to get back. I'm at the point personally where I think you only play Shelovs under duress. Like, and this is a situation, like, I thought it was pretty obvious that you had to go the back-to-back with Lankinen. I thought the criticism around it was got a little bit silly. Like, Lankinen's pacing to play like 55-ish games this season. Going back-to-back in that level of usage shouldn't be a taboo. You know, and talk it's an absolutist that he doesn't want to do it, which, by the way, I also support. But there are times that call for extraordinary measures, mm-hmm. and this back-to-back was one of those times, clearly. And, you know, the Canucks-Hughes usage speaks to it too, right? Bringing Hughes back for that Calgary game. Like, that was one they had to have. So, you know, I thought back-to-back there made sense. He needs to play against Utah because that's another one you have to have,
mm-hmm.
right? Absolutely need to have it. So, especially based on, like, you know, Chicago's a game you should win, but it's not a gimme these days the way it has been earlier on in the season, especially if you end up facing Spencer Knight. Especially coming off the emotional high of Wednesday. I mean, that was like a playoff-type game, and now you're going to go play the Chicago Blackhawks? Like, you know, you got to be...
With Utah on the other side, with another playoff-type totally, game on like, the other side.
That 60 minutes is pretty dangerous from the old trap game perspective, right? So I think this one's clear, just like the other one was clear. I think it's got to be Shelov's against Chicago. You know, in some ways, too, you put Shelov's in net, that's a wake-up call for the team in front.
You hope so.
You know what I mean? Like, hey, guys, we're going to need to be on because, let's be real,
you better carry over those vibes from Wednesday to put your best foot forward in front of Shelov's.
And maybe it's Shelov's with a short leash. You know, you have Lankinen prepared to go in if necessary, if Shelov's gets beat on a couple point shots or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, I think you've got to go Shelov's, and then I think you've got to give Lankinen Utah. That Utah game is just as crucial as the Calgary game.
Oh, 100%. It's right there. And that game against St. Louis coming up on the road trip is a big one.
No, but
as well.
But Utah's actually good.
They're all big, though.
I know, but Utah's the actual good team among them, right? Like, that's why the Utah one matters most.
I just like bringing up St. Louis to you.
Oh, man.
For that reaction specifically.
It's fine. I'm honestly just exhausted because it's just like, you won't be bringing them up in 2 weeks.
On the decision to start Lankinen in the back-to-backs, and as you said, the criticism of Tocchet getting a little out of hand, that's not the only topic on which that is the case. And I know
we're in absolute silly season.
People have already like pegged us and a lot of people on the station here and a lot of people in the media as like Tocchet apologists or whatever.
That's fine.
Nobody's saying he's perfect. Nobody's saying he's a perfect coach.
I'm fine. The whole market was Bruce Boudreau apologists, and I was like pretty critical. And I think that's aged well for me.
But some of the things...
Whole market called me Travis Green apologist. Mm-hmm. That's aged well for me.
Some of the things specifically right now in the last week, and look, I get it. It feels like until that game last night, it felt like the team's season was completely slipping away and was going to just be a disaster and a slog to end the season. So, of course, there's emotion. People are looking for criticism. I get that. But even like the Nils Höglander ice time thing last night, it's like, as you pointed out, well, he made a brutal play in the third period that could have cost the team the game. But even beyond that, you look at 5-on-5, he played the third most minutes of any forward. He played more than Elias Pettersson. He played more than Connor Garland. He played more than Jake DeBrusk. He played more than Filip Hedl. That's a lot of minutes. That's a big opportunity for Nils Höglander. He doesn't play special teams. Now, if you want to say, hey, with the way he's played over the last couple of months, he should at least be getting some power play minutes in there, power play two, especially with how, you know, Tocchet's splitting the units up and all that. Okay, that's fine. But the idea that he didn't get an opportunity last night, that he wasn't rewarded in any way, he was playing with Elias Pettersson and he played the third most minutes 5-on-5 for forwards. That's a great opportunity. That's not Rick Tocchet burying Nils Höglander in the lineup. The other one that's driving me nuts this week, I don't know why I chose this moment to get all of this off my chest, but the other one that's driving me nuts this week is Rick Tocchet's already ruined Filip Hedl. He's already coached all the creativity out of Filip Hedl. It's like, Filip Hedl was a talented, tantalizing, but frequently disappointing middle six forward with the New York Rangers for his whole career. And guess what he is now? He's a talented, tantalizing, but frequently disappointing middle six forward for the Vancouver Canucks. The idea that he was this incredible player when he arrived just a month or so ago, 6 weeks ago, and Rick Tocchet has squeezed the life and squeezed the creativity out of Filip Hedl. Come on. Come on, people. What are we talking about? By the way, he's still doing his controlled entry thing. There just hasn't been enough end product. And that's frequently been the case for Filip Hedl's career.
I also think, you know, people are pretty bad about evaluating coaching, I think.
Sure.
I'm very confident that a lot of this market's coaching takes over the years have been bad.
Well, let's not even limit it to, like, let's not pretend like it's a Vancouver thing.
No, it's not. But
you know what I mean? Like, coaching, I think, notoriously
I think this market in particular has been especially bad. I think the Bruce There It Is conversation, you know, the way that Green mm-hmm. was talked about after that, the way that Boudreau was exalted, the complete inability of anyone in the market to understand what was actually happening there, honestly, like, shook me. Shook me more than it did when this market turned on Alain Vigneault. Like, I'll never get over it. I just don't think this market has a good handle on coaching talent. And here's what I'll tell you right now. For the Philip Hedel has been ruined by Rick Tocchet file. The New York Rangers have categorically got less out of elite young players, or potentially elite young players, in terms of NHL-level development than just about any other franchise in hockey. Just look south down the I-5 to Capo Caco. Look at the New York Rangers and what's happened with Keandre Miller's form flatlining. Braden Schneider's lack of development. Alexis Lafreniere. Right? I mean, Caco would obviously qualify. I'm pretty confident watching the Rangers play a lot these days, just because that race is fascinating to me, and I think it's very clear that they're not as good as teams like Columbus and Ottawa, that if you swapped Tocchet and New York Rangers head coach Peter Laviolette, the Canucks would be 5 points shy of where they are today, and the Rangers might be a playoff team. The Rangers actually might be a playoff team. Very confident of that.
There you go. I think that's fair.
Maybe we see it next season.
Well, maybe the talking part. I don't know about the Peter Laviolette part. You never know, I guess.
Laviolette won a Stanley Cup with whom?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. With the Carolina Hurricanes. That's interesting. I'm going to be thinking about that one now. Quickly on the goaltending point.
Hey, because the Canucks always like to trade coaches with the New York Rangers. Once a decade, we got to do it. Mike Keenan, John Tortorella.
Torts and AV.
Hey. Third time's a charm, baby.
Yeah. Last point go. On the goalie thing before we get out here. Keelan Mack texts in, is the track running out for Shelovs? If he isn't challenging for a spot next year, he's going to be just a guy. That is a big part of this conversation, is what, like, is Shelov still, can Shelov still be in your plans for the future in the crease in any way? Or do you just have to treat it as, If he turns it around, that's a bonus, but we got to take care. We got to protect ourselves in other ways. We got to invest in other ways because we don't know what we're going to get from Shelovs beyond this year.
If you don't trust Shelovs to start against the Chicago Blackhawks on Saturday, then he isn't in your plans.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Patrick Alvin was sure to remind us that he can still make trades after the deadline.
That's true. Just can't play in the playoffs.
If you don't trust Shelovs.
That's a great point.
If you don't
would
trust.
Would this be the time for a post-deadline trade just to get a goalie in?
If you internally, if the folks off of Griffith's Way today are sitting in a boardroom or sitting in Rick Tocchet's office and debating seriously not starting Shelovs against Chicago, then you should be on the phone. Like, you should be, you know, bringing in X dude, Hunter Shepard from the Washington Capitals or something. Or actually, they have a better American League goaltender. He's actually a local kid. I wish I remembered his name offhand.
There you go.
Anyway, Clay Stevenson, baby. I like him better.
Producer Zach on the spot.
Clay Stevenson. Like, you should be, you know, whatever, sixth round pick. Like, send Shelovs to the American League. Let him play. Like, if he doesn't leap over, we trust him to give us a chance to win against the Blackhawks, then he's already not in your plans.
Yep.
that's my view of it.
All right, we'll leave it on that note, and we will wrap up the show for today. We'll be back tomorrow, Friday edition of the show, looking ahead and previewing the big two games back-to-back over the weekend for the Canucks. That's tomorrow on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.